One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Message and data rates may apply. Consult a doctor prior to use.
Wow, you look amazing. What have you been doing?
I'm sure you've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and the other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, I found this great company called Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe medications like Ozempic and Wegovy and other GLP-1 medications that are 80 to 90% less expensive, all 100% online.
I can get GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% less and do it all online? No doctor's office or pharmacy?
Yes, Zelthy can provide semaglutide or tirzepatide, the active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s. But for 80 to 90% less and ship directly to your door.
How do I get started with Zelthy?
Call #250 with the word care to get started today with Zelthy. Get the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less and 100% online. Don't wait. Call #250 with the word care right now for a link to your exclusive offer. Call #250 with the word care. That's #250 with the word care. #250 and care.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
This is Leslie Kane, and you're listening to That UFO Podcast.
Now let's jump into it.
There's a few we haven't touched on that are definitely going to come up here now. So Rob asks, topics of interest, Skywatcher's latest, and also any reactions from anyone in Congress to Matt Brown's revelations. Is there more to come from this, I wonder, or is that it? So start with the second one first then. I've not seen many reactions from anyone in Congress to what Matt Brown has said. As the thing was, he did speak to them before. So that is something that was confirmed through those interviews, that those conversations, I imagine, have already been had. Jeremy Corbell said he walked Matt Brown into the office of congressmen and women. You would imagine Luna, you would imagine Burchett, you would imagine Burleson, and others would have been involved there potentially. And they would have heard those conversations beforehand, perhaps more, given what they would be able to speak about in those settings. More to come. I've got to think that we'll hear more from Matthew Brown in the coming weeks rather than months.
Yeah, and Corbell seemed to hint at that directly in one of his recent interviews, that there's a lot more behind the story than they already released, that Matthew Brown has more content that he hasn't shared and may never share publicly, but there seems to be some really meaty material there that that he's holding close to the chest, which I would hope so. If he feels like he does, that he's in danger and his career has been threatened, all that kind of thing, then I hope that he does have some really powerful evidence to share with the world, if in fact he needs to. So yeah, I do think we'll hear more, and I think that these Congress folks probably have heard from him, at least some of them. But I think what we forget oftentimes is that Congress people hear from a lot of people all the time, and
yes,
we tend to think that, you know, your Burchetts and your Lunas and whatnot are, you know, fully on board with this subject and they're keeping up with it just like you and I are keeping up with it, and they're not. I mean, that is very apparent in the kinds of statements that they make, and when you have the hearings, the questions that they ask, they're fairly high level. They're not, you know, in the weeds, and that tells me that they just haven't done the kind of deep dives that the rest of us have, who are, you know, really fixated on this subject.
Yeah, they're weak when it comes to the UFO topic. You're probably lucky if a couple of percent of it is spent on that, and amongst all the stuff they have to do. And I doubt they go home at night and watch UFO documentaries and listen to UFO podcasts and everything else in between. So they're very much getting their information from a select number of sources. And it's probably difficult given, can you imagine, let's just pick Tim Burchett. He could literally be getting the bulk of what he knows from Lou Elizondo, Jeremy Corbell, and Stephen Greer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's three pretty different takes and narratives on the UFO topic. But, you know, we've heard Greer has briefed people in Congress. Now, if that means he handed them a document outside and they've went away and read it, or maybe they have watched a Greer documentary because they know the name, they know the face.
Mm.
That's how they're getting their information. They're not going to some secret library, opening a drawer and it says, here's the UFO file. They just don't have that. So I think that's where I understand people's frustrations, but I would say, you know, preach a little bit of patience at times with elected officials and folks coming into this topic new. It must be difficult to not only hit the ground running, but then have a load of folks. It was funny, you described earlier Sean Kirkpatrick as arrogant and the most intelligent guy in the room. Ironically, he would fit really well into some UFO circles, because that's some of the, and even I get that from people sometimes. I don't like to think I come across like that, but other folks will try and impart how incredible their knowledge is compared to mine. Mm-hmm. And I'm not comparing myself to anyone. I'm far from an expert, folks. I like to think I'm nosy and inquisitive, mm-hmm. and I know a little bit, but some folks' knowledge on this topic far, far, far exceeds mine. And I would lean on them for stuff, but there can be an arrogance and an aggression that comes along with that. How can you not know what I know? Mm-hmm. And then along with that, not only comes the facts that they know, but their own opinion is ingrained within factual awareness as well. And they'll just spout their own bias rather than keep things factual. So it must be difficult, like you say, to come into this topic and try and get anywhere near a place of being up to speed, because I don't know anyone in that, and I mean anyone in this topic, who's always got it 100% right 100% of the time.
I mean, you can't find them, right? And imagine being in the shoes of somebody like David Grush or Matt Brown, who are trying to get Congress folks to look in certain places, and you only have a certain amount of their time. You can't just, you know, give them deep dives and expect that they're going to retain all that content. You got to get them to act on a specific thing that you want them to look at. So yeah, it does tell me that we're pretty far away from more comprehensive conclusions about what this might be. And remember, in the legislation that had been introduced in the years past, there was this whole call for this disclosure task force, you know, this group of people who would be assembled from a variety of different subject matter fields, and they would, you know, analyze the information and release that information to the public over time after they'd done that kind of deeper analysis. I mean, that's the sort of effort that we're going to have to get. You know, some folks who are dedicated with teams of researchers looking at all of this content, both public and private and classified, and trying to make sense of it. It's going to take quite some time, because I think, and you know, maybe I'm wrong, but there's probably very few people that have a comprehensive picture of what this really is.
Speaking of which, the first part of Rob's question there was on Skywatcher's latest. Mm-hmm. Now, folks, Skywatcher's latest, they commented on 23rd of May. We've been quiet for the last few weeks, but we've been cooking behind the scenes. Much more coming soon. I know the folks in the Discord chat will love the coming soon reference. And then on May 28th, just a few days ago, they released their first of their UAP modules. Now, this is something they did allude to before, and they've posted a couple of short video clips, I believe, with James Fowler, Marek von Rennenkampf. And for example, number one talks about UAP Class 1, the Tetra shape. You find about some of their basic data. It links to, for example, here, sorry, I'm reading, and if my mic goes a bit funny here, I'm just looking to the side. You go onto the Skywatcher site. The video is a couple of minutes long. It talks about, you know, tetrahedron shape, often in groups of 3 to 20. Visual profile is black with intermittent white vapor burst, rough size estimates, and then a little bit of information on characteristics, interactions. But what folks seem still a little bit unhappy with, and the second one, sorry, is the Tic Tac, is there's a lack of data provided with this. So again, this stuff seems great for the uninitiated. Look, it's a real base level introduction to the UFO topic. I think for many of us, we perhaps selfishly feel we've been here before, Nathan, where okay, here's another group going to take us all back to square one, right? That's fine. We know this. Most of the public don't. So maybe we still have to go back there. But again, I can't help but feel back at the beginning when Jake Barber came out on News Nation with Ross Coulthart, they alluded to Skywatcher being much further along than they're now presenting that they are. That could be for any number of reasons. However, how do you feel, Nathan, that this is where we are right now with Skywatcher? Bearing in mind, they've given a one-year time frame by the end of the year that they would have released substantive data and information.
I'm going to be honest, I'm frustrated. I'm frustrated that they made some pretty big claims early on, and those claims haven't yet come to fruition. At the same time, I applaud what they're doing. I really enjoyed the interview that Jesse Michaels did with James Fowler, the deep dive.
I've not managed to watch it yet. It's something I'm going to try and get to this week, but yeah.
It's definitely good. There's a lot of good content there, and Fowler does a good job of explaining, you know, how long he's been at this, the kind of things that they're trying to do to get this information.
But ask you a question, and Nathan, on that? There seems to be a little bit of misinformation online, not deliberate or anything sinister, around James Fowler has declared a few times now, and I believe again in that interview, that he's been doing this for 5 years, and people are equating that his doing this for 5 years is that Skywatcher has been going for 5 years. And there seems to be this thing of, well, if they have been going for 5 years, why is this all we're getting? And that's not the case, is it?
No. Yeah, that interview, I think, cleared some of that up for me as well. So it sounds to me like Fowler has been trying to pioneer technology, like the dog whistle is a good example of this, technology to study this in addition to other in-the-field applications. So not just UAP, but other applications in the field where the government may want to use a similar kind of tracking technology to understand what's in the sky. And so he's talked about he's putting his money and his efforts behind that kind of technology. And he's got contracts and contract history with at least some government agencies, it seems, to understand what's in the sky. But only recently has Skywatcher itself been more of a formal thing. And that cleared that up for me too, because I was very confused when they said, oh, we've been operating for 5 years as Skywatcher, and that Jake Barber's been part of us for that long as well. And I'm like, well, how does that timeline make sense with Barber's other statements that he was sort of like red teaming, these whistleblowers, and he was at that Greer disclosure conference where he, vetted Michael Herrera's testimony. And, that none of that made sense to me in terms of the overlap, that Barber wasn't necessarily kind of on pro team disclosure, and then all of a sudden he was, but he'd been also part of Skywatcher for 4 or 5. None of it made sense, but apparently that's only been more recent that Barber has been part of that organization as such. So it does seem to clear things up a little bit. I echo the frustrations that people have shared that, well, they've been around for this long, or they at least they've been trying to gather information for this long. Like, is this the best that they have? And I'm not convinced that this is everything that they have. I think that they're holding a lot of stuff close to the chest, and that, like a lot of things, there's timing is everything. And I think we're going to see some future drops from them that are going to be more compelling or more comprehensive. In many ways, a lot of this stuff is like keeping things on a slow burn, rather than like coming to a boil, they're keeping things on at a simmer. And that may be intentional to, kind of maintain interest, but not get too far ahead of something else that may be coming down the line that could be really important and groundbreaking. So I don't know. That's purely speculation on my part. Maybe even a little bit conspiratorial on my part. There's kind of a coordinated effort here across different parties and organizations, but that from an outsider looking in at doing this for as long as I have now, it seems like that is what is at place taking place here.
So here's something that might upset a few folks, because I love playing devil's advocate. I really should just have a part of this show called Devil's Advocate, right?
Quite good at it.
Thanks. So, given that they're not asking for public money, that they are not a public company, that they are privately funded, that they have private backers, and there still seems to be a whole lot of people desperate to know who, but they have private funding from individuals, it looks like, through the whole SALT conference initiative and Alex Klokas being the kind of the head of that kind of thing. And that's why Gary Nolan, Carl Nell have spoken at these events. people in the background are there. Your David Grushes are there. Your Jake Barbers are there. And they have conversations behind the scenes, off camera, with venture capitalists, people looking to invest, people who for the average, you know, for them, $500,000, $1 million isn't a lot of money. And it's money they've got to throw about into interesting projects because that's the capital they have behind them. Given that's the people funding them, are they beholden to the public, to us at all? Because what do they, again, I'll just say it, maybe they think, in a way, well, what do we owe them? We're being quite open. We don't have to be. They could have done all this behind the scenes. And if Jake Barber hadn't came forward, he could have still had that investment, been still working on this in the background, told us nothing. And this could be nothing more than a whisper that there was a project going on with some ex-military guys. Ross Coulthart knows about it. Jeremy Corbell maybe knows about it. But we're not hearing anything from it. And that's all it could be. So given we know this, is there a question we should be grateful for what we do know, as opposed to demanding answers for something that right now, I get the whole phenomenon is a humanitarian issue and going to be, but what they are doing as a small independent organisation, as independent as it can be involved with the government in a way, isn't really anything to do with us. Just putting that out there, Nathan.
I mean, I think it's a great criticism. I mean, who are their stakeholders, right? Are we their stakeholders? No. You know, their moneyed investors are their stakeholders. And in terms of what they're giving the rest of us, I mean, it's just probably giving us stuff because there's such a public interest in it. And I haven't seen calls from them for additional public investment. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something you might expect to see if they're going to drop these modules and say, you know, we need more funding to pursue this further. Here's where you can donate or to invest in our efforts. You're not seeing any of that. It's so really they're just kind of giving us scraps because they know there is interest. But where is the meaty material and who's getting that material? Further in that interview with Jesse Michaels, you know, Fowler talks specifically about releasing this in a way that they're giving the government a chance to tell them to stop, basically.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, I think that's very interesting and it makes sense. A lot of these folks are, you know, either in active military to some degree, or they have military contracts, or they're patriots. In other words, they've been part of the U.S. You know, defense apparatus to some degree or another, and clearly seem to take that very seriously. And they're releasing this content to give the government a chance to step in and say, well, hold on now. We don't want you to do this publicly because you're filming genuine stealth technology and black budget programs that we have. And so I find that to be a noble effort that they're, you know, really trying to be careful about this, but also frustrating. You know, it's sort of like, well, I mean, does that mean that if you do happen to record some black budget tech that is also like the Tic Tac, that the public's never going to know anything about it? Because that's sort of implied in that interview. That we may never get that material. So yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, the other interesting take that he had, that Fowler had, was that this could be the way for the government to slowly release the truth that the government has some kind of breakthrough technology that they've been working on for decades, and they just have no good way to tell the public about it. So they're going to kind of drip it out to an organization like Skywatcher, and that allows them to sort of get the public caught up with some of these groundbreaking technologies without maybe revealing all of their cards. So that's an interesting theory, and it has nothing to do with, you know, aliens, non-human intelligence or anything. It just has to do with, is there kind of breakaway, breakthrough government technology that's been held from the public? And of course, there's a lot of speculation that is true. So very interesting, and I think that points that we shouldn't, you know, put all of our eggs in that basket, eggs, by the way, expect that Skywatcher is going to be this sort of incredible disclosure advocate that we're hoping they're going to be. I think they're making a big impact, but I think we need to be a little skeptical that we may not get everything that they know.
Yeah, the first option with the dog whistle and giving the government the opportunity to stop at this, it very much sounds like Jake Barber and co. have stood next to the model village and said Beetlejuice twice. And they're waiting on someone stepping in and going, nope, don't do that a third time because we know what happens, and let's call it quits there. The second option, though, I don't know on that one around breakthrough technologies, because there's then, it depends what it is, but then as soon as it's in the public realm, as public knowledge, China, Russia both have knowledge of that. You would imagine the US, Russia, and China have a level of knowledge of each other's breakthrough technologies anyway. Perhaps that pushes, if the US release a new type of propulsion to the public for public consumption, would China then have to follow suit and be like, well, yeah, we can do this too? Did Russia then have to follow suit and go, yeah, we can also almost do this, given how the Ukraine thing's gone? Still looks like war's a little bit Neanderthalish in comparison. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but it's a strange situation. We'll see where Skywatcher are in a couple of weeks, couple of months. But right now, I'm still quite happy to sit on the fence and wait and see what comes out. If we get to August, September, October, and we're still just getting modules landed on us, I would start to really ask, who is this for? And at some point, are we going to see the updates in the background? This is something that personally frustrates me with like the Jesse Michaels stuff, where the Tech Bro podcasts get these really big guests on,
mm-hmm,
because they've got money. It's not necessarily they are the best folks to get the best questions asked, but I can get the same guest on as Jesse Michaels usually, and he'll get three and a half, four, 5 hours, because they can pay them, bring them out, give them a nice time over a weekend. Joe Rogan does the same thing. And there's a few newer podcasts like that as well. I think sometimes the smaller interviewers or podcasts, or even the non-UFO leaning podcasts, can get information out that perhaps people really want to hear, or at least have those questions asked, that I don't know if that comes out when you get to spend a weekend with the guys and all that kind of stuff. But
yeah,
pros and cons. Like, I've heard some really good interviews on much smaller podcasts and shows than some of the bigger ones can get as well, but they've all got their place. But yeah, that's me just moaning about that. So I'd love to see Skywatcher reach out and speak to some of the other grassroots efforts, which would be nice. But again, to my point, they don't owe me or other grassroots efforts anything. It'd just be nice to touch base now and again. Mm-hmm. And you know, funny, you mentioned the egg thing before. You joked about it, Nathan, which I appreciate, a good egg pun. Isn't it funny that given what came out in that Jake Barber piece back in January, that's almost forgotten about in all of this, that mm-hmm video was there?
It's crazy.
Like, that should have been the big news from it, and it wasn't.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I think it does kind of speak to the fact that we live in a time where we're getting a lot of information on this subject. I mean, like you said, that would have kept UFO enthusiasts busy for many years if it had been the only thing released in a calendar year. People would be talking about it for quite some time, but it, like you said, it's been quickly forgotten. That's because there's just so much happening in the news cycle with this content. So
does it speak to the quality of the actual video itself though as well?
It could, right? It could. I mean, the public's attention span is very short, right? So I think, yes, the answer to that is that it could be better and it could be more convincing and compelling. I tend to look at these things, and I think you do as well, from the totality of the evidence. It's not just that imagery, it's the testimony, it's all this stuff that you had to put together. But that requires more legwork on my part to do that. I've got to hold all that information together and make a conclusion, rather than just look at a video and go, aha, look, it's really compelling, and like that's an alien spacecraft, you know.
Yeah.
So I get it. I get why it may not be at top of mind for folks, but I don't know. All this boils down to me, like, is it just incredible frustration? And I hope that folks appreciate that, you know, if you've been following this and been a fan of your show for many years and been following this content, like, you're probably feeling tired and frustrated and burnt out even on this subject. I think that's a fair reaction, because it feels as if we're doing a little bit of hamster wheeling here. And that can be not fun. But will we see some breakthroughs soon? I think yes. I think there's a lot of stuff happening behind the scenes, and all of the things that we've heard in the last few months are proof of that, right? I mean, think of the efforts of James Fowler for years trying to get this content, and nobody knew he was doing it. Like, think of how long, you know, Barbara was involved in this and actively kind of gathering the other folks to be involved and trying to get this. Nobody knew about this at all. Very few people knew about this. So that stuff's happening all the time. Like there are groups doing stuff all the time that nobody knows anything about. There are whistleblowers nobody's ever heard from that are just waiting for the right time to come forward. And in many ways, it's sort of like, I'll put myself out here. It's like, you know, I haven't really shared what my last name is. And that's because I'm kind of waiting for a certain momentum shift where I feel comfortable enough to put it out there and not feel like it's going to influence, you know, my career, my family in a way that I can't control. But I'm a very, you know, I want control. So I want to be very careful about what I do.
I'm going to announce now it's Nathan Skywatcher. And that's
exactly.
That's the big reveal.
Exactly. So, yeah. So you can see, you know, you can see why there might be some folks who are just waiting for the right time and they're waiting for a certain amount of momentum to shift to step forward. And I think age of disclosure will probably do that. You know, you'll probably get more folks stepping forward in the wake of that film, in the wake of Matthew Brown's testimony. You're going to see more folks who are willing to stick their necks out there and, you know, does it just have the snowball effect that we hope for? I hope so.
Yeah. To put it this way, like, I mentioned being back at the gym for like 10 or 11 weeks. If you follow your progress in just one way and weigh yourself on a daily basis, some days you will weigh more than the day before. Mm-hmm. And you could have worked out the night before. You could have starved yourself, which I do not recommend folks always eat, right? I do. I'm sensible about how I go about it. But that's one way to measure progress, and it'll be a roller coaster and you'll dip up and down, but the line will gradually go down, but it'll be peaks and valleys and troughs all the way, right? However, you can measure your progress in different ways at the same time. So I weigh myself once a week, and compared to last week, I am a pound heavier. I have a t-shirt that didn't fit me that well 2 weeks ago that fits me well now. So I have lost body fat, but I weigh slightly more. That could be any number of reasons, water retention, all that kind of stuff. All this to say, folks, it's not a dieting podcast. I'm no expert. But it's the same with the UFO topic. Just because things look a bit weighty or leggy or heavier in one respect doesn't mean things don't fit better, but you just haven't realized it yet because you're not seeing that progress just yet. Jeremy Corbell could have spent 3 months live streaming every day. I'm walking down the halls of Congress with a whistleblower behind me, wink, wink, you know, but I can't show you who they are. People would have been furious. Instead, what Corbell and Knapp have done, and we don't know Knapp's full involvement with all of that. He stays quite quiet in terms of how involved he is. They just released their Matt Brown interview, and bang, there's the author of Immaculate Consolation. It drops. There he is. Ah, and we get a 3-hour interview over 3 weeks, which again, I think people were angry. It was split into three parts. But once they saw why, I think it had a really good impact. It let people digest it. It let people soak up aspects of the conversation that may have been lost in the totality of the full interview. I think we saw that with Jake Barber, where we had a 45-minute cut and a 3-hour director's cut, but it had a lot more context to it, and it allowed you to take that in more. Apologies for the ice cream van going off in the background there, folks. Not mine, just the local one. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of work happens. We don't see or hear, and then bang, you'll see the fruits of it. So it can be frustrating. But like Nathan says, if you're tired, if you're like, where's the next thing? Just remember, we had months and months and months of Matthew Brown in the background, and all of a sudden it landed. So I think it's been a really interesting year so far, if you look back on it, maybe more so than the first half of 2024. And I can only see that gathering pace as we go along. I can't see it quieting down this year in any way, shape or form. So take a breath now and again, but be sure things are happening in the background as well. Not always in the background, Nathan, sometimes deep underground. And Peter wanted us to talk about deep underground military bases, DUMBs or DUMs. The network may be more extensive than is known. Is this why disclosure is so strenuously resisted? Trillions of taxpayer dollars spent providing sanctuary for the elites. So if anyone listened to my interview with Melinda Leslie, apologies, it just went on the YouTube channel. Melinda had a cold and I had to do a lot of editing on the interview. And for anyone who watched it, and you'll appreciate Melinda will say this herself, Melinda talks for a long time when you ask her a question. There's a lot that I had one sheet of paper that were just edits. So I had to spend a lot of time on it, and I was a bit lazy with it. So apologies it took so long. But yeah, we recorded that before her interview with Ross Coulter on News Nation, which went into that in more detail. So the audio folks heard it a few weeks ago. The YouTube folks just heard it. It's a bit of a, it's a deep dive. It's mm-hmm. it's a lot of information to be thrown at you. But this idea, Nathan, of deep underground military bases, exactly what it says on the tin. You can go down the route of, we're harboring aliens under there, we're harboring exotic technologies. It is just military bases deep underground, and there's miles and miles and miles of tunnels. How far do you go with that whole notion?
I mean, this one fascinates me. They clearly exist, you know, the extent of their you know, sort of infrastructure is I think probably highly classified. You know, there's a great piece by UAP Gerb, who is a kind of a deep dive researcher. He's got his own channel that talks about these things. And I mean, they're fascinating, right? And if you think about it, like, that's one of the best places to keep secrets would be under the earth, because it's so hard to get information about them. You can't rely on satellite imagery, you know, other than what you can see in terms of surface level activity. Now, how do you take that secrecy a step further? Well, you connect some of these bases together so that surface activity that might occur miles away is related to activity that takes place in a base, you know, in some mm-hmm. other place. And so you can't, if you're China and you don't know that, you know, point A and point B are connected to each other, then you don't know the amount of resources that are, you know, being placed into point A, because they're arriving at point B and then being, you know, taken underground and shipped over to point A. So an incredible way to keep secrets from your adversaries if you can have these kinds of deep military bases and facilities. So they do exist. I don't know, you know, how large they are. And, you know, these claims that there might be miles and miles of interconnected tunnels, I mean, that's fascinating, right? I mean, I want to see these things. There are claims that there are whole, you know, sort of city infrastructures in some of these bases
yeah.
that would, you know, store the high-level politicians and families and things like that in the event of a nuclear catastrophe or some other catastrophe. And I think that's the other thing. Like, we're getting a lot of speculation this year in particular of impending cataclysms, right? We're getting a lot of rumors and anxieties around just what might be coming. You know, you hear this recently from Ross Coulthard about, you know, 2027 and Corbell in 2027 and Ramirez and, you know, all of these things that could be happening. And why are these bases really there? Are they there for just, you know, standard run-of-the-mill military secrecy? Or are they there for some deeper purpose, protecting assets in the face of a future calamity that some people know about, but most don't, right? I don't know, but this makes for fun speculation, and I try not to get too wrapped up in it, because it can be also very anxiety inducing if you allow yourself to go down that rabbit hole too far.
Yeah, I would go as far to say the underground military stuff, 100%, it makes sense, especially now that the skies aren't classified. You know, China, Russia, the US, everyone can spy on each other now. So it used to be you could stick Area 51 out in the desert with a fence around it, and even the most expensive satellites would struggle to pick these things up. Now they can literally read the license plates on the back of cars covered in dirt. You know, the AI side of things as well, you really have to go the other way now, where you're burrowing underground. We've got all these you see the big drills that have made things like the Eurotunnel and whatnot, and that drill underground. It wouldn't be that hard for decades for these things to have been made. And I would imagine they do have extensive, perhaps it does go a bit speculative, but I love it. The railway networks underground that we don't know about, all that kind of stuff. If they've got secret space programs, they've got secret railway networks. They could have secret fucking bus routes for all we know at this point that are taking people from A to B. That would be disappointing, wouldn't it? Like a bus underground, like God.
All we've got is a bus. Yeah,
I know. We've got a bus. We don't have the hyperlink rail that's on like a gravity track, but we do have a bus. But it's a nice bus.
Hyper
but yeah, in terms of what Melinda goes into with the military having these bases, are they harboring NHI technologies? That would make sense. Rather than have them in a building, you would have them stored deep underground. in locations where you could blow tunnels, old school, and seal them off, much easier to secure. Members of the public can sneak into a building. Even the most high-profile secure buildings, I imagine they can sneak into them. You can get into Area 51 past the fences if you get the right time and blah, 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 blah. I imagine it's much harder to get 100 or 300 or 500 feet down underground into some elevator that's fingerprint access, and all that kind of sci-fi stuff we know and love is probably far more realistic than we expect. But yeah, that must be some of the real top classified shit though as well, as to where the locations of these things are. Because again, just because entrance, Melinda talks about Sedona, out in Arizona, isn't it? As being a location for these. You could have Compound A, which she was saying it's like you get the trucks going in and out as if it's a quarry. Mm-hmm. So it can just look like a quarry on the base of things, but there may be an entrance the quarry masks. But that doesn't mean then that once you go through that entrance, that the actual site of any activity isn't 5 miles away.
Right.
Again, that's why these sites could be so useful. So really interesting stuff. And if anyone knows of any other speakers on that kind of topic, it's pretty speculative, but I don't mind going there if folks want to hear it. So yeah, really interesting on that. So thanks, Peter. Jonathan had asked us to talk about Luna posting about defunding Arrow, which we did. Chris and Nick both asked us to touch on what you've just brought up, Nathan, around Ross Coulthart's latest comments on 2027. Now, this was on another Australian UFO program, UFO YouTube show. I hadn't seen the title of it. Do you want to give us your quick thoughts on this again, just while I find out the name of the program? Because sure. I want to find that.
Yeah, this has been swirling around for a while now, both in, you know, kind of back channels and public channels. This notion that there is something big happening in 2027. You hear it from a lot of different voices. You hear it from Chris Bledsoe, you hear it from John Ramirez, you heard it from Jeremy Corbell as being kind of a false flag operation. You hear it from Ross Coulthart, who says that he's being told something's happening in the near future. But he also, in that same interview, said, well, you know, I also hear that it could be 2034, or it could be the 2040, or it could be...
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that happens all the time. And I think it's helpful to have that historical perspective. If you're just new to this and you haven't studied history and the history of ufology, you know, and other religious movements for that matter, you may not be as familiar with these sort of end of the world predictions, but they, every decade or so, every generation essentially has their end of the world prediction. And, I think there's something existential tied to that. You know, we all realize that we're mortal at some point and realize that the end of the world's happening. And so we kind of then concoct these grander catastrophes for all of society. And they're very appealing. They're very, you know, fun. In other words, it's kind of disaster porn. In other words, you get really excited about it. But I think it can be dangerous, you know, it can be very anxiety inducing and unhealthy if you get too fixated on that, because they often come and go with little to no fanfare. And then the people who make those predictions, I'll call out somebody, Steve Bassett, you know, who says that disclosure is happening every month, you know, and disclosure is coming next month, or Danny Sheehan is doing this too. You know, this is big and it's going to happen in a few months from now. And, you know, are these guys intelligent and knowledgeable and have connections? And, you know, absolutely, you know, and do they produce great content? Absolutely. But you know, if you cry wolf too many times or the sky is falling too many times, no one's going to believe you. So I think you'd be really careful about those kinds of things. And I appreciate what Ross has said, that he's getting lots of different predictions from his sources and he doesn't really know what to believe. But there is a level of urgency, I think is kind of the words that he used, that the tone feels very urgent in his sources, that people need to know about this because something is coming. And I don't know what that is, but it's certainly intriguing.
Yeah, you've covered a lot of things I would have said on that, Nathan. So it was on the UFO ZZIE, so the UFO Aussie YouTube channel, and it was Reese Dalton Morgan who conducted the interview. So people should go and check that one out. It's only an hour and 40 minutes, and the chapters are there as well. And like you say, it's that piece is only a couple of minutes long, but of course that's what's going to get clipped and put online. Ross doesn't say anything new there that he's not said before and others haven't said before. I think he's very fair to say, look, I've heard that date, but I've also heard this date and this date. It could be anything. And it makes me wonder, did folks have these conversations back in 2013, 14, 15, 16, even about something's happening in 2017? And what it was Lou Elizondo left ATIP and came forward and announced, you know, what he announced, or the New York Times article before that launched. So it's really difficult. Ross Coulthart covers the bases as well, again, very fairly, and says, you know, it could be AI gaining control over all our computers. It could be an asteroid impacting. It could be aliens revealing themselves. Who knows? Could be a new world government taking over and martial law declared. But again, it's all very Western, isn't it? Because our folks and the other half of the planet talking about this and teening about this. And I love the phrase, the term disaster porn. And you also followed up by saying coming and going without any, you know, impact. So yeah, that'll work wonders on the algorithm, folks. But yeah, I appreciate that. And I know what you mean. I've got Stephen Bassett coming back on in a week or so. And I love listening to Stephen, and many folks do. But I also appreciate when I spoke to him last, December time, early January, December, and he said he felt the first 90 days of the Trump administration would see disclosure.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. We're about 120 days into it now. Mm-hmm. So Stephen is very, very optimistic in the UFO topic. Danny Sheehan can be similar. So I think that's when we talked about before, when you've got your Mick Wests at one end of the scale, you can't be too far the other end of it either, that you accept everything as being the next thing. Mm-hmm. And I imagine a lot of the audience that listen to this and to perhaps like the way I approach the topic, Nathan, I think you're very similar, is that you can hold that middle ground and be like, well, this could be really interesting, but I am also ready to be really disappointed. And I've said that about anything and everything with the UFO topic for me. I'm ready to be disappointed, but I'm also very open to being pleasantly surprised. I will download and pay for Stephen Greer's app the day I think that he is onto something modern day, not like he was back in the day. I'm not going to be that stubborn, but I think you've got to be careful not to go too far either way. So regarding 2027, I don't know. Again, like, I suppose if we're going to talk about this being a UFO show and it being a UFO thing, Nathan, my issue with putting a date on anything is you're then saying that either aliens or an NHI have given us a date based on our own calendar, that they literally are working to a clock to say, yep, around this time we're going to do this. That doesn't seem realistic to me. That seems very, very human.
Right.
So then it would have to be, and I don't want to throw this out there, but that whole idea that something is traveling here from far away.
Right.
You could pinpoint that and say, we have found a craft and it looks like it's roughly 1.5 years away.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1.5 light years away from us, and it's traveling at this speed, and it's going to be here in 2027.
Yeah.
Right. That would be the only logical, as much, and I say logical really loosely, way that a date would work. I don't see that humans and ETs have had a discussion and decided that something will happen in 2027.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and how interesting would that be as well? 10 years after the New York Times piece that really kicked off the latest level of interest and momentum on the subject. So that very much sounds to follow along with your theory, a coordinated rollout plan. You know, it's a 10-year plan where this is how we're going to do this. We're going to start with here. We're going to do a lot of podcasting. We're going to do a lot of, you know, pushing it in the social spaces and the community.
Documentaries.
Absolutely.
All that kind of stuff,
we're going to raise the temperature a little bit. We're going to get it into Congress. We're going to raise a little bit more. We're going to get it, you know, into legislation. We're going to raise a little bit more into some more tangible evidence of this phenomena through the release of organizations like Skywatcher, perhaps the James Webb Space Telescope, et cetera, et cetera. And ultimately we'll finish the dish, you know, in 2027, and we'll have set the stage well enough so that the public at large is now more prepared to listen to whatever we want to share with them. So that's, again, very conspiratorial. I'm happy to speculate in that regard. Certainly does tie things up in a nice, neat little bow. But if that happens, I think we have to skeptically also ask, well, you know, clearly this was a plan. And what are they telling us? What are they not telling us, right? I mean, there's certainly a lot of elements to this and a lot of avenues worth exploring. I think I completely agree with your perspective and approach. Let's keep this in a middle ground state. Let's take it in. Let's observe it. Let's not necessarily fall or land in a conclusion. I think it's just another data point that we have to evaluate in this entire story.
Yeah, so it could be the DOD isn't the Department of Defense, but in 2027, it's a decade of disclosure because it's been a decade at that point since 27. Yeah, I've not heard many folks actually say that before, that 2027 will be a decade since the New York Times article. So is it that was the, that could have been the countdown started. It could have been bang, we've got 10 years to get this out now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, interesting idea. There you go. Nathan's cracked it. 10 years since 2017 is why it's 2027. So who knows? Do you know what? It will get tongues wagging if they delayed age of disclosure till 2027. That's the ultimate in marketing right there. Do you know what?
Mm-hmm.
There's an additional scene at the end that we've not added for the South by Southwest.
Boom.
We can't release this till 2027. What a way to market. Yeah, so there we go. Octavio asked us, Nazca Mummy's deep dive, which we can't do right now, Nathan. I don't know how much you've got to add to that, but I've not followed it closely enough to say, other than I know there's people still working on it that we can see with the Nazca Mummy specimens. And also to comment on the sphere that landed in Colombia, which I can mention. Ronnie Vernet, Brazilian journalist, posted some interesting snapshots online of the Buga. Is it Buga, Colombia? Is that what it was?
Buga? I'm not sure how it's pronounced. Yeah, Buga.
It might be Boga. Yeah, it could be. But it's Buga, the Buga sphere. And he's posted a side-by-side comparison of a rocket fuel tank, which is like a 9-liter rocket fuel tank. And if you look at them side by side, they look very, very similar. It'll be in the description on the thumbnail for this podcast, folks. I will save that picture right now. So it is definitely there. But it's a really interesting comparison. And for me, it looks like he says, almost customized. And that explains why it's constructed from aerospace grade aluminium alloy. I know there are folks saying there have been reports. I have not looked into it that much. For multiple reasons, Nathan, but also because, again, the Jaime Massan connection. Jaime Massan has been involved with so many hoaxes. You mentioned earlier the boy who cried wolf stuff. If Jaime Massan legitimately had, if a flying saucer crashed in his back garden and a non-human intelligence said to Jaime, we want you to reveal us to the world, I don't know how much I would believe it, because it just wouldn't be the guy to do it. Because of all the rot. But then, is that downplaying someone's work and effort in a field over decades? I don't know. But for me, that the Ronnie Vernet comparison does look remarkably spot on. Like, it's a customized fuel tank. What about yourself? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think I share your sentiment here. It's a wait and see very much for me. I want to acknowledge that's kind of my bias too, right? I'm a little biased against these kinds of releases, not only for Jaime Massan, but also just the number of times the community has been hoaxed over the years through, you know, video or similar kind of content. So it's tough to take it seriously, but at the same time, I mean, I do keep an eye on it. I'm watching it, you know, develop. If there's more analysis done that says this is something truly anomalous and not man-made, I'm open to that. But I agree that the connection here to the fuel tank seems pretty compelling, at least at first glance.
Yeah, the article from the Daily Mail, and again, the Daily Mail isn't a bastion of truth, folks. I'll just say that honestly from a UK perspective. It does publish a lot of shit at times, but like most tabloids do, they commented that scientists have released the first X-ray images of a mysterious sphere-shaped object recovered in Colombia. Locals claim is of alien origin. The so-called UFO was spotted in March over the town of Buga, zigzagging through the sky. It was recovered shortly after it landed and has been analysed by scientists. There's like a video of a sphere zigzagging through the air. It says Columbia 2025. it's got some symbolism and marking on it. And it, again, it says here, comparing it to ancient script. But they're going to use AI to decipher it. Anyone could have made that. I mean, again, I would love this to be genuine, legitimate, all that good stuff. But I fully see what Rony is getting at here. But again, more science, more data to be done and see if anything interesting comes to it. I can't really add much more because...
Yeah, too early.
A lot of rumour and conjecture. But when it comes to having physical evidence, that changes the conversation for me. If you want to, Nathan, tell me an incredible, fantastical story about a sighting or an abduction experience that you've no physical evidence for, I will listen and judge that on its merits. I won't dismiss it out of hand. But if you bring me a piece of evidence and say, this has come off of an alien craft, or this is something that was flying about in the air and has landed, I think it's alien, cool. Give that to scientists and let them decide. You know, I suppose with the Nazca mummies, if that was just a story and there were claims that there are caves that have been discovered and they've got full skeletons or mummified remains of what looked like non-human intelligence from centuries ago, but we didn't see any bodies, we had no evidence from it, I would judge it differently. I would speculate probably a lot more on it. But since you've actually got the physical proof, that's where for me it's like, give it to science, let them do the science, and then we kind of have to go from there. But I also appreciate, from a layman's point of view, for me, it's not as easy as sticking something under a microscope and going, oh, yep, it's alien, because that's not how this works.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where a lot of people get frustrated. I get that.
Yeah, completely agree. And I keep an eye on these things. I mean, the Nazca mummies, had a pretty lukewarm reception initially, but there seems to be ongoing science. And the number of different mummies, I'm not exactly clear on how many there are, but there are quite a few. And they're in different sort of, you know, shapes as well, sizes, I guess. But it, you know, from what I have observed on it, it seems to be a little bit more compelling than I thought it was initially. So, you know, very interesting. It's intriguing. And yeah, I do want, more scientific analysis. But, you know, there are those who are really proponents of these things and say a lot of scientific analysis has been done. There are people who have done the scans. Yeah. They've done, you know, so I had to take that seriously. What is it? And this speaks to like our bar for truth. Like, what is the right person who has to come along and say, you know, this is legit for us to go, oh yeah, well, I agree. Like, is it a Gary Nolan who comes along and says, you know, I've analyzed this and it's legit. Is that where people will be on board with it?
Yeah.
Is it what scientific body has to throw their weight behind it? I don't know, but it speaks to the challenges I think we face just largely in this topic, that, you know, who is going to be the credible person or agency or whatever that will tip the scale and get people believing that this is true.
Yeah. And even with the results, this is where people will say, oh yeah, but there has been data published. I don't understand the data. Just because something says, oh, isotope A has a radium percentage of 12 microns, and I'm making up language and terminology here, folks, but that's what it's looked like. It's reading gobbledygook to me. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know what that means. So someone could say, well, what that means is it's alien. I would have to take their word for it, but then I can look like a total moron. And if that's the case, that there's data being publicized that's already pretty conclusive, I would expect folks like Gary Nolan and others to jump all over this, but they don't. And again, that's my kind of bias, where I would expect them to and they don't. And I would expect more mainstream to pick up on the story, but they don't. So it's frustrating because it's almost a bit of a lose-lose. And like you say, it really needs a groundswell behind it. And we tend not to get that with this kind of stuff. And we just have to sit on it.
Yeah. I mean, it'll like, what happens if China releases something similar? Do we take that seriously? It's just because it's coming out of Latin America, you know, South America, are we you know, more skeptical than we would be if it came out of the US? I mean, I think those are legitimate questions.
Like, it's second rate science, and it's not at all.
Totally.
But totally. We wait and see. We wait and see. Paul asks, do you think that NHI should be changed to NHSI, non-human sentient intelligence? a dog, a rat, a dolphin, even have intelligence that is non-human. I know it's splitting hairs, but NHI could be bioengineering of some kind or a trained life form. Just a thought. I would like no more abbreviations because there's enough of them that even for me, I get confused sometimes around UAP. Is it anomalous? Is it aerial? Is the U unidentified? Is it unmanned? Is it? It gets to a point. I totally get your point, though, Paul. Yeah, but do you know what's funny? The more we try and label things, and I think Skywatcher were guilty of this, Nathan, really early on. Where I again, this speaks to me for getting it. They had the dog whistle and they had the psionics. Mm-hmm. What they then changed to meditative something,
yeah,
calling, signaling, mm-hmm. and it was like, for the love of God. A UFO is a UFO. We know what it means. We know the connotations. Alien is alien. Call it any. And I do this as well. I'll interchange NHI, UAP. Again, for a broad audience, I'm trying to make sure folks understand the terminology being used across the board. That's why I do that, folks. However, UFO and alien, for me, cover all the aspects of this. UFO is exactly what it says on the tin. Orb, sphere, disc, triangle, whatever. Alien is NHI, interdimensional, extraterrestrial. Mm-hmm. It's not human. For me, I'm happy with that. But yeah, I get you've got to appeal to the masses. And there's a thing that's not even masses. You've got to appeal to so many different sections of this topic, new and old and everything in between, Nathan. Don't know how you feel about that.
No, I agree. It's exhausting. And I think like we're grappling with what is intelligence right now. And the 21st century is really confronting us with that concept. You know, what does it truly mean to be intelligent? What has intelligence? What, you know, how intelligent are bugs versus humans? What is the height of intelligence, the depth of intelligence? We don't have good answers for that. And let's introduce another variable here. We've got artificial intelligence, right? That's coming yep. along very rapidly. And so, you know, how do you classify all of these things? I tend to agree with you that alien is such a great catch-all because it has this otherness quality to it, this foreign quality to it that I think most people understand. But you know, there's also the conventional understanding of alien, which just is something from another planet, another solar system, what have you. But I tend to think of alien as just, you know, very much the other than conventional human intelligence, conventional human experience.
Yeah, I think it's that idea of, in modern day, even saying UAP or NHI to ordinary member of the public, you end up saying UFO. In the same way you say X and you say Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Even still, people talk about wrestling. I know there are some wrestling fans listening to this and enjoy when I bring it up, but WWE is WWF. Very few folks think of the WWF as the World Wildlife Fund, which actually it has been since, I believe now, May 2002 was the last time that wrestling used WWF.
Wow.
And then jumped over to WWE. It's been almost 25 years, folks, since that change. But if you say WWF, I think for most folks right now in your mind, you've got The Rock, Stone Cold, and Kurt Angle. Back in the Attitude Era and Ruthless Aggression Era, all those kind of halcyon days of the early 2000s doing nothing. So yeah, it's just what it brings up and what springs to mind. So for me, UFO, alien, let's keep it simple, but hey ho. That's why it's called That UFO Podcast.
Exactly.
Dave, last couple of questions. David says, I'm wondering what you think of Eric Burleson saying he has been told the Tic Tac is Lockheed Martin tech. I know this is something that has been said before, but with Grush now working for him, that would seem to add a new element. In other words, did David Grush tell Burleson who to talk to? Personally, I think more recent Tic Tacs could be Lockheed, but the one David Fravor encountered in 2004, that seems very unlikely. Go on, Nathan, take it away.
Oof, yeah, this is, you know, definitely controversial. You know, I think the traditionalists will say it's impossible that it would be Lockheed tech because they'd already be using it. They'd be getting contracts over Boeing, over others, for example. I think those are very rational arguments that it's not Lockheed. On the other hand, maybe there is some sort of deeper than Skunk Works kind of department within that organization that has this technology, and maybe they operate in a way that is outside of the normal auspices of the governing structures of Lockheed, and they can do whatever the hell they want to do. I mean, this is something that you'll find some really strong advocates one way or the other. I tend to be skeptical that it is Lockheed for the conventional reasons that people say. At the same time, I've said before that the Tic Tac as an incident is, you know, it's truly interesting because of the behavior characteristics of the Tic Tac. That this, you know, you think about Fravor and Dietrich and you know, the air crews that were vectored out to that position, and they wouldn't have seen anything had it not been for that, you know, cross-like disturbance on the surface of the ocean that is an X, if you will. X marks the spot. Pay attention to me. You know, it's zipping around. It's erratic. It wanted to be seen. People have certainly speculated that maybe there was something under the water that it came out from the ocean. But a more prosaic explanation could be it's doing something to get the attention of these air crews, and this is how it did that. And then it zipped up to see them, and did its little display, went to the cap point. I mean, all of this is a very hey, look at me kind of behavior. Look at what I can do kind of behavior. And what did that event catalyze down the road in terms of the things that we now see happening in that discussion? It very much was a starting point, if you will, on this journey. So it's it has a human like playfulness quality to it that makes you think maybe this is a human controlled object of some sort. And if we can, in fact, manipulate gravity like people say we can with these objects, then the pilots of that craft would not feel the G-forces that normal pilots would feel in an aircraft. And so this argument that they would be, you know, sort of jam on the inside of the craft in that acceleration just don't have any merit, because they don't experience gravity. They don't experience it in the conventional way that a pilot would in an aircraft. So, it's possible. It's certainly possible. It definitely brings into the conversation the breakaway civilization and the, you know, these hidden agendas and who's really pulling the strings. I mean, you can go on and on in different, you know, avenues of inquiry here. But I do think if Lockheed had this tech in a patent folder somewhere in the main office, like they'd have every single contract, you know. So it's an argument against it being a Lockheed craft. But I don't know. I mean, this Burleson-Grush thing is interesting, right? Like, we don't really understand the nature of how much Grush has shared and Grush's day-to-day involvement with Burleson's office. So, you know, did Grush give Burleson this tip? I don't know. I think, like everybody, I want to hear more from David Grush, right? When are we going to hear more from that guy? I hope we do hear something soon, because I think he needs to speak. He has probably maybe the greatest credibility of the most recent whistleblowers, and he's been the most quiet, which is frustrating.
It goes back to what we said earlier with, you know, is Eric Burleson, again, picking the names out the hat, is he getting his information on the UFO topic from Lou Elizondo, David Grush, and Stephen Greer? And then who is he speaking to? I very much doubt he's sitting down with David Grush and saying, well, tell me everything about UFOs. Is it more of a consultant where, as and when they speak and as and when they need the help and as and when they send David Grush some documentation to look something over, we're proposing this, what do you think? We don't know that level of involvement, and you're completely right, Nathan. We need to hear from David Grush to really drill down on that. Being Tic Tac, the Tic Tac being Lockheed Martin tech, I still don't think the Tic Tacs were manned. I don't think anything alien or other was inside them. However, that then begs the question, why would something 40 feet in size, why would it have to be that size then if it wasn't going to contain something? But then we don't know the something that would be inside it. If indeed there was anything inside it, it might not be hollow. You know, that's an assumption again, that it was hollow. It could have been completely, it could have been, you know, solid all the way through. We don't know. We hear, you know, people saying as an aerogel and all that kind of stuff. And it very, very strange technology that we don't completely understand. Like you say, the behavior, the erraticness. If it was something that was AI controlled, that was let's go with my thinking, is it was something that was manufactured here. It was manufactured under the water. I do put some, you know, credibility into this idea of there being some kind of facility under the water that does move when it's approached. I can totally buy into that. And that the government is potentially aware of it, I say the government, the folks that need to know are aware of it, it creates these things like the Tic Tacs, like certain spheres, and the purpose of them, if it's to go up and observe, you know, when you see like a sci-fi movie, and I think, or even let's talk about Batman and the Batmans with Christian Bale, great trilogy of movies. Won't hear anything bad said about them. And the Batmobile has like a loiter mode, and then it goes to intimidate, and it starts to be more threatening. It shoots missiles, and it's, but loiter, it just kind of hangs about. Are the Tic Tacs programmed to, you know, just observe? It's got an observational mode, and to observe from an artificial intelligence point of view with another species like humanity, to not engage with it is be playful. Just zip about, don't engage, keep your distance. And it is almost like puppyish. You know, like that's the way I kind of think of it. It's very playful, very harmless. It's just there, but it's there to do a particular job and role. Whether that's observational mimicry, whether it's scanning, you know, we don't know. But that's the way all that kind of comes across to me. And maybe my mind changes on it now and again, but I don't believe that. But again, like you say, the David Grush connection is really interesting. Eric Burleson's going to have all kinds of folks in his ear. And bear in mind, I've not looked through the list and I wouldn't even know, but I imagine Burleson has sponsors and people who fund his campaigns would be involved at various levels. And there would be some folks for whom it would be useful for Eric Burleson to believe this is man-made technology. Don't look too much into this UFO thing, Eric. You know, when's your next campaign coming up? There's another $500,000 in the account. And I'm not saying bribes, but they literally fund these people's political campaigns. They need money. That's how that works, doesn't it? So no poor person ever is going to get elected to Congress or become president. That's just the way of it. Yeah. You can like Obama as much as you want. I was a fan of Barack Obama, you know, especially from the UK outside world point of view. He had millions and millions and millions of dollars behind him. That wasn't a rags to riches story, and you wouldn't get that at that level. They all need money. They all need to do favors. They all need political influence. And you would have folks whispering in Eric Burleson's ear, all kinds of stuff. So, yeah, probably long-winded answer to say I don't know, but it's an interesting dynamic to have that Grush involvement in there. Anything to add, Nathan?
No, I think you covered it really well.
Thanks. Last one then from the Southern Oracle. So I'll read this to you, then we can get to answering the crux of it, Nathan. The phenomena is almost certainly multifaceted. In other words, I feel it's pretty obvious we are dealing with multiple types of visitors or phenomenon, yet most people label all of them as one thing or another. Do you think that semantics or labeling of the different things we are seeing is the hitch in the giddy up of our community? For example, we end up dividing the community over whether some of the phenomena is angels and demons versus interstellar beings. In my mind, these are just labels or words we tie to a particular historical encounter or sighting, when in reality they are the same thing, just being labeled through the lens of one's particular worldview. Can you see us as a community ever overcoming these types of labels that divide us so vehemently?
I'm going to say no. Because that's just how we are as people. I think we're, you know, we all have our frameworks of looking at reality. Those frameworks serve a purpose. They help us, you know, function in the lives that we lead. We all have a story of ourselves and how we fit into, you know, our families and our societies and all those kinds of things. And that story is very important, you know, kind of orients us in a world of a lot of chaos and uncertainty. I think it's maybe a lot to ask that we have kind of a universal framework shift to where we could all maybe agree in the same, using the same sort of words to describe the same phenomena. I do personally believe that that is a true assessment, that, you know, people are using the words and the language that makes sense to them, that they're translating these experiences into objects, beings, whatever, that are easiest for them to understand. And so that's why you get so many different perspectives, you know, that it's angels, it's demons, it's robots, it's aliens, it's ET, you know, it's interdimensional, it's ghosts, you know, that there are all kinds of different ways in which this manifests in our stories, in our mythologies. I don't think that's going away. But I think understanding that is important, right? So I think that, you know, this particular question is great because the more folks who understand that this is happening, then it's easier to have these conversations across different perspectives, right? So if you're in a conversation with somebody who's really in the angels and demons camp, understanding that that's their perspective and, you know, kind of they're grounded in that worldview, that's helpful, as opposed to just combating them and saying, no, it's not angels and demons, it's ET, you know, like, yep, you're kind of taking them. I don't think you're going to get anywhere like that. I think you have to understand where people come from. But it does raise the true challenge here of getting real traction in this subject. And whatever the official explanation for this that I think we'll ultimately get, if we get it at all, it's going to be a story that makes the most sense for the most people, right? And that said, and I've said this before as well, that we're moving into an age, there's a paradigm shift taking place in the world with our technology where things are rapidly getting weirder than our traditional narratives are able to keep up with. And so we're entering a time in the future where we're going to have new tools, new technologies, new ways of understanding reality. And that context that is foreign to you and I, because we've grown up in a world that's not like that, that context is going to shape the way in which we explain the phenomena in the future. And it may be that that future and the weirdness that that future represents provides us the best new context to explain what this truly is. And so that may be why we're kind of like stuck running in place, because we've not had a shift, a great enough paradigm shift in the world with our technology by which we can explain and have this sort of parallel to what the phenomena really is. So the way AI is shaping and changing our perspective on what can be done, what reality looks like that's going to influence the way we talk about and understand what the phenomena really is. And it may be better suited to what the phenomena really in fact is. So we'll see.
Yeah, I can't answer any better than that. And I think I would hark back to what I mentioned before around the idea of UFO versus NHI versus UAP versus all these different acronyms. UFO and alien, we know what we're talking about. The general public know what you're talking about. I think that stigma is there to an extent still, regardless of what labels we use. And then you can start to lump in ghosts, poltergeist activity, and various things like that as being very similar phenomena. When I spoke to, you know, like a Jim Semivan who talks about beings and sightings and entities, you know, there's the word entity, being in a room. And if you're listening to this, you start to think alien, NHI, other podcasts, you could go on like a spiritual podcast or one on ghost hunting, they would immediately think, oh, ghost, spirit, demon, and it's something different. But is it all just the same thing? We don't know yet. And I think you're quite right in terms of we've got this big specter of AI hanging over us now. And I think culture, as you go through the decades, for us, we're like, I'm almost 40, so I'm 39, Nathan. I'm guessing you're about similar.
Much older,
yeah. You're not in your 60s
yet. 46. I'm 46.
40, yeah, but you're not like, you know, you're not that much older than us. So like, but we've had like, in our lifetimes, a time of limited technology as children, where we didn't have, I got my first mobile phone quite early. I think I was like 14.
Mm-hmm.
I had a mobile phone. I was one of the first kids in my school to get one because I was desperate. But I also hear, folks, I had a pager. And I don't know how big those were in the States, right? But you might wonder, I was like 13 years old. And for Christmas, I asked for a pager because my dad had one for his work. Uh-huh. And I will let younger folks who aren't aware of what a pager is go and look up. Well, I had a Motorola pager, folks, right? And that was one of my favorite things. And we then went from the physical medium for music to MP3s. You know, and we're coming away from hardware being more and more necessary. We went from having lots of hardware to everything being in one device. So then I think we went from like that kind of like technology explosion to technology becoming smaller and more compact to less devices being needed. We then had social media influence our society in a huge global way. And I think the next thing that is now starting is AI. This is going to influence us hugely, that I think the world would look very different in 5 to 10 years. even without any kind of disclosure. But to that end, and I think you touched on this, Nathan, is that AI explosion and expansion and integration into society going to result in paradigm shifts and discoveries of new sciences, new truths? Do we discover disclosure through an AI process? I don't know, Nathan, I don't think you know, but it's something we are going to find out whether we want to or not. Mm-hmm. And it's how we kind of adapt to that as a society along the way in the coming years. Maybe by 2027, Nathan, who knows?
Yeah, you never know.
We don't. But listen, we'll leave it there because that is 2 hours, Nathan, you've been with us, and a hell of a conversation. So thank you very much. And thank you everyone who sent in questions. I think a few came through as we've been recording. I don't have time to go back through those, but I'll stick those into the next show, folks. Dan may or may not be back for those, depending on his travels. It'll just be sporadic when he's available. But Nathan, thank you so much again. Very welcome jumping in.
Pleasure.
What are you up to at the minute? How can folks find you?
Yeah, you can still find me on Twitter or X. I'm going to say that forever, I guess, at Awaif Soul. And that's the easiest place to interact with me. But I also have, as you mentioned, a couple of podcasts. So Liminal Frames and Calling All Beings. A little less on Calling All Beings lately, but we're planning some new shows over the summer. And Liminal Frames, I'm on roughly every 3 weeks with that. And that's Exo Academian's podcast. He's got other great content worth checking out as well. Yeah, and I'm also on your Discord. So if you're a fan of the show, if you have that UFO podcast, feel free to, at me, and happy to jump in and we'll have a chat.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Nathan. And thank you everyone for listening. Remember, folks, shameless plug, my book is available to pre-order. I am not going to always bang on about it, but thank you to everyone who has pre-ordered so far. The Genius link is in the description. It takes you to your kind of local Amazon, or there's a few other options on there as well. Barnes & Noble, Waterstones, bookshelf.org. But yeah, thank you so much for checking that out, and I speak to you all very, very soon. My new book, Atlas of Unidentified Flying Objects, is now available to pre-order wherever books are sold, including Amazon, Barnes & Noble and Waterstones. Explore the UFO phenomenon through 34 cases from throughout the world, with accompanying pictures and maps in a beautiful hardback edition or download for your Kindle. Links available in the podcast description below.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at cosi.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at cosi.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at cosi.org.